Good morning. So last time we talked a bit about implementing malloc. So we discussed that our operating systems give us memory to programs in these big chunks, typically on a modern system about 4 kilobytes at a time. It's the minimum unit you can get from the OS. And it just takes longer for the OS to allocate or deallocate memory because it needs to change some data structure the hardware uses versus just like giving you a pointer. So typically we have libraries which implement functions like malloc and free and use these OS interfaces but get these big chunks of memory from the OS and divide them for you because you're allocating like linked list nodes and we want that to be fast and not waste lots of space per allocation. And that's what these libraries do. And that means that they have to have some sort of data structure that tracks all these free chunks of memory. So one example is they could have a linked list of all the free chunks. They might have multiple linked lists for different sizes. And they can use this to hopefully efficiently give you memory and not waste lots of space when you allocate things either by actually allocating extra space every time you allocate something or not being able to use the free space between allocations for some reason. We also talked about the memory hierarchy. So this is the notion that we have these different technologies that we use to build memories. And generally, when we have these small memories, and the smallest example we have are these memories that we use for like registers, which have very small capacity, and then we have these things called caches, which are typically on our processor physically. And these were very small, so they could be fast, but they had pretty limited storage. And then we have these slower and slower memories, including sort of the generalization of memories into SSDs and hard drives, which store a lot more data, but are a lot slower. And the ideal we want to give to programmers is that, well, it looks like your system operates with the speed of the fastest memory. So we have these tiny caches, which are pretty fast, like orders of nanoseconds per access. But, it looks like you have the capacity of the largest memory. And the way we maintain that is with caches. So caches are going to hopefully mean that most of our accesses go to the small memory, but that we can still have the capability of accessing a whole lot of storage by occasionally having accesses go to the large memory. And of course, this isn't generally possible. We are depending on our programs accessing things in a way which lets us store some stuff in the small memory, and that ends up taking care of most of the accesses. And fortunately, there's this empirical property of programs called locality, which makes this possible. So typically, when we access a value in a program, we access it again soon. Typically, when we access a value in the program, we access values which are adjacent to it in memory. Think like an array. If you access an array element, you're likely to access soon an array element that's next to it. And because of this, caches can actually do the job of making them store things that are most of what we access. And they just follow the policy of keeping recent data, so that takes care of you access something over and over again, and nearby data, that takes care of the case you access adjacent array elements or different variables within an object. Those can all be what we call cache hits, and they can be fast. And most accesses fall into this sort of locality category, so it ends up that we get something much closer to the speed of these smaller memories than the speed of our slow memories. And this has become more and more important because we have this gap between the speed of memory and the speed of processors. So it used to be in the 80s that memory and CPUs were about the same speed, that you didn't care if you accessed memory every instruction, like the real main memory. Like that was no effect on performance, really. And CPUs were designed with that in mind. But as processor technology improved. Processors got a lot faster. Back in the 80s, 90s, we're talking about like tens of megahertz, and that's related to the speed per operation. And up here, we're in the gigahertz range. Hundreds of times faster. And memories indeed also got faster, but they're not as quickly. And things have kind of settled out, that memories have not been getting much faster in the sense of time per operation, and processors have not been getting much faster in the sense of time per operation. And some of you, including people from last class, pointed out, but wait, haven't computers still been getting faster? Don't processors still get faster? Doesn't memory still get faster? Like, we have DDR4, which is better than, DDR2 and 3, which is must be some of the earlier points on this graph. So what's happening? And this is time per operation. So this is the amount of time from when I start doing a memory access to when I get the result, or the amount of time from when the processor starts executing, say, an add instruction, until when it writes the answer back to the registers. And that has not been improving very much. But performance has been improving, and it's been improving by improving the amount of stuff we do per unit time. So we're doing more stuff, but it takes the same amount of time, which means we must be doing more different operations at the same time. And that's what's happening. Or we must be doing bigger operations at the same time. So memories have gotten, transfer data faster, but they still take about as long once you say, I want to access starting at this memory location, give me that data. But when they start giving you the data, they give you that chunk of data faster than they did before, and they let you have more operations in flight. CPU, similarly, take about the same amount of time to do each add from start to finish, but they can do more of them at once. Or they can do multiple cores. That's another way we get more of these operations. So we have just more operations per unit time, and that's the way that in the past decade or so we've been improving the performance of computers. Because it hasn't been worthwhile to actually improve the time per operation. Instead, the most fruitful way of improving performance generally has been to focus on increasing the amount of operations we can do at once, or increasing the amount of stuff each operation does. Like in memory, we might request more data at the same time. So any questions about this? About this difference between, so this first quantity, time per operation, that's sometimes called latency. That's when from start to finish. The second quantity of stuff we do per unit time, that's sometimes called throughput. And given that throughput's improving, you should not think that it's because we have no idea how to make latency better. We do have some ideas about how to make latency better. They're just, but there's a choice of what you do when you design a processor. And the best thing to do might not be to have the lowest possible latency per operation, because that's not what our program does. Like, our program executes a million instructions. The question is, how fast can you do that? Not how fast does each instruction take to execute, if you can do parts of multiple instructions at the same time. And that's what modern processors do. Okay, so after this high-level talk of CPU performance and memory performance, talk about a more low programming language topic, just about strings. And strings, particularly in C. So in C++, we have a string class, and it works basically, first approximation, the same way you expect a string buffer to work in Java. I would say string but strings in C++ are mutable, the string class. So that's more like string buffer or somewhat class like that. But other than that, works basically like what you've seen. Strings in C are a bit different. So C doesn't really have a string type. So instead, they use pointers to characters. And the convention in C is that we have a null character at the end. A common question is, well, can't I put this null character and this backslash zero? Like, first of all, what is that? So this is the same as char of zero. It's the thing with ASCII value zero. So the convention in C is that when you have a string constant, that's how it's represented in memory. So it's a pointer to the first character and is terminated by this zero, this actual literal ASCII zero, not the character zero. And if we want to have a literal zero in a string, well, you're going to have a hard time telling where the string ends. And C is a society that we don't care about storing strings with zeros in them in this way. You can still have such strings in C, you just have to have some other way of tracking where they end. And so, given this layout, we're going to have our pointer, presumably on the stack, to called hello, and it's going to point to the first character, and these are all going to have normal ASCII values. Any questions about this string representation? So this is what string literals do in C. And this is the form in that C functions conventionally pass strings around it. Not the only choice, because, well, it's not called string. You can do other things. And there are functions based on this type for manipulating strings. So one is stringlen, which gets the length of a string. You may notice all these functions have six character names. This is an unfortunate historic thing about how C worked. When C was originally designed, I believe that there wasn't good support for functions with names longer than six characters on some systems, or something like that. Or they just decided they all wanted to look the same, but either way, we're stuck with this from many years ago as the names. So we have string len, which is the number of characters in S. This is the number of characters excluding the backslash zero. String copy copies from one to another. And string cat appends from one to another. And unlike our string types that you may be used to in, say, Java or C++, these functions are just pointer array manipulation functions that you could pretty easily write. So, for example, here is a complete implementation of stringlen. We just treat S as an array. It's basically an array. And we iterate I until we find the backslash zero, which is the same as zero cast to a character. And we return the final I we get. That's string len. So let's look at some of these other functions. And in addition to having unfortunate names, these functions are probably unfortunately tricky as far as like rules you have to follow when using them, and perhaps weren't the best design in retrospect. So one idea. So here's some code. This is valid C code. It's not valid C++ code, but it's valid C code. So what would you expect to happen if I ran this? Okay, so you're expecting that, okay, so we have hello points to, so string copy, okay, so first thing, you say hello would be equal to by. Yeah, so string copy, the destination is first, and that's the same with string cat. So this is the destination, and this is the source. So we have hello, which is, you know, H-E-L-L-O, exclamation point, backslash zero. We have by, which points to an array of B-Y-E, exclamation point, backslash zero. And you're saying that by gets assigned hello. So conceptually, we overwrite the H with an E, the E-Y with an Y, E with an L, the exclamation point with an L, the backslash zero with an O, and then we write past the end of by. And string copy does nothing to stop that. But it actually doesn't work for a different reason. So this is what we expect to happen. So you say, okay, so if we're allowed to write past the end of by, that should still work and hello will be equal to by. But if you run this on a typical system, the result you'll get is a segmentation fault. And the reason for that is, so the actual result is seg fault in C. And the reason for that is that this memory here is marked as read-only. And when you try to write that read-only memory, you get a seg fault. So there's just an arbitrary rule that you're not allowed to change string literals. You have to copy it into a local array. So you could instead imagine doing something like care by, have a character array for by. You know, that's five characters, and set it equal to the string by, and this is legal syntax in C and C++ to do that, rather than setting each individual character, and work that way. So we could do that, like so. So here we have, now we don't have local storage, and this is the same as just assigning character by character from hello. And this means that we're going out of bounds. And this probably should seg fault, but probably won't. So it should seg fault because, well, we're out of the bounds of the array, but that's only actually going to be a problem if that happens to be memory that we're not allowed to touch. And the way the operating system works is it allocates memory to you in 4K, 4 kilobyte pages. So these 4 kilobyte chunks, if you don't get outside of that chunk, it's not going to seg fault. And our fix for this would be that we could, that if we did, say, you know, 7 here, that would be completely legal. But this is a caveat with these C string functions, is that they neglected to take care of memory allocation. They say, you're responsible for having enough space for these operations. That when you do string copy, you need to make sure the place for copying the string is big enough, even though the string is variable length.
If you were doing something like scanning input, how would you allocate the right amount of space for like a string,
So the question is, if we're like scanning input, how do we allocate the right amount of space? Well, you probably are gonna use malloc, and you probably need to depends how you're scanning your input. Like if you get it character by character, you can easily deal with like reallocating the space, and that would be a typical thing. If you're using something like scanf, are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So if you're using something like scanf, which is the basically the inverse of printf, did you see printf in the lab?
Yeah,
which is the inverse of printf. So it's like printf, but instead of writing stuff out, it reads stuff in. If you're using scanf, basically you should never use %s with scanf, ever, because it is not possible to use safely. But you can use format strings where you specify the maximum length.
Okay. So you're put a stipulation on this, is like how long it should be.
Yeah. Or like you read each, or another common technique is you read each line into a fixed an array of known size, and then you can use %s because you know the total size of the line. And you just make sure your input, the things you're reading into are that big. But generally, the C string functions are designed from a time when people were a lot less concerned about malicious input into programs. And they make it extremely difficult to deal with that. Because like this convenient string copy function, you know, is not really what you want if you want to worry about someone inputted too much stuff because they want to break my program. So, with string copy, so here, how about this better use of string copy? So rather than needing to allocate this right amount of space in advance, we'll just use malloc. We'll take the string len, we'll add one. So why did we add one? That'd be a good question. So we add one, this is for the \0. So this at least is not incorrect. It doesn't go out of bounds. It's not likely to segfault. Probably going out of bounds and not segfaulting is worse than going out of bounds and segfaulting, actually, but it doesn't go out of bounds. But there's probably a problem with this, which is that this probably leaks memory. We don't know for sure because we don't know what this do something with function does. But the question is, You know, if do something with doesn't free. And we say it leaks memory because when foo returns, well, unless do something with stash des somewhere, we have no way of accessing the des pointer. So either do something with better have freed it, or it better have put somewhere where we can free it later. And leaking memory, from the standpoint of you think about implementing malloc, it just means that we have something which never gets onto that list of free chunks of memory. So we're just going to keep it around. We're never going to give it back to the OS. And in C, there's no way for it to discover that it's there. Now, that is still there and get rid of it. In Java, you're used to the implementation. You know, it knows where all the pointers are, and it can figure out, oh, you don't refer to this anymore. In C, that sort of information is not preserved by the compiler to make that possible. So it doesn't know what's in your, you allocate it to memory, it doesn't know that you have, whether or not you have pointers in there. It doesn't know whether or not, it can't figure out whether there's any remaining pointers or something. So let's talk about stringcat. So stringcat is concatenation. So first of all, what's wrong with this piece of code? So this is code which is subtly broken. I thought it was broken. So what does this code do? So here we have string copy and then string cat. So note that we copy first because we don't start with anything, and we don't know that malloc returns an empty string. Commonly people assume it does, but malloc doesn't initialize the memory it returns. So it doesn't necessarily start with zeros, it could start with anything. Most notably, if you freed something earlier, the same stuff might still be in that memory and malloc might return that same pointer. So here, we allocate space for the hello, space, and world, exclamation point, and the /0. And we add the hello, we add after it, the world, exclamation point, and the /0. So here, the result is going to be hello, space, /0 is what's going to be stored in there. And afterwards, we're going to StringCat's going to iterate to find the /0, so this is not very efficient, and going to replace it with a W, then the rest of world, and then put a /0 at the end. So StringCat's pseudocode is find /0, copy over the /0. Okay, so any questions about this? So, since we talked about memory leaks, so here's some code with a memory leak. So first of all, let's figure out what's the memory leak. Second question, of course, is how do we fix it and not change what the code does? This code gives the correct answer, it just leaks a lot of memory. Yeah, so we never free either result or S. And you might say, well, okay, so you can free result. So that takes care of that. And you might say, oh, but S goes into result, but we still aren't done, so what's the problem? Yeah, so when we free result, result is equal to the last value of S. And here we lose the previous results. So we never free whatever result was before we last assigned it equal to S. So even though we're freeing results at the end, this still leaks memory. So what we want to do instead, and that's exactly why, we want to free result at the end too, but we need to free it before we overwrite it. And note that we can't do this earlier because we need to copy from it, so we better free it after we copy from it, not because it might go away. We might actually give that memory back to the OS. But this is the sort of general pattern you have to use to actually deal with your memory leaks, is that you don't just need to worry about getting rid of the variable when it goes away. When you change where a pointer points, well, you need to worry about what happened to the old pointer. That's often pretty subtle. So here, you know, we're dealing with the old pointer before we replace it. If we don't do that, nothing else will, because there's no other copies of that pointer around anymore. Also note that this code is, in addition to initially having memory leaks, which we fixed, this seems like pretty inefficient. So we're basically doing something n squared to construct a string of just our arguments. And we probably could avoid that. Because remember that this iterates through result, this iterates through s, and argv s, the string that we've constructed. So we're basically, iterating twice through our partial string every iteration of this loop, which probably a better version of this code wouldn't do. And so what we probably really want to do, if we wanted to implement this efficiently, is we want to instead have a pointer to the current end of the string and use probably realloc. Or a simpler way is that we'd have one loop while I is less than argc, the length plus equals string len. So get a total length of the output result string. And then we iterate again, and we copy to result plus, our index. That would be a more efficient way of writing this, first figure out how much to allocate, so we only allocate once. Even if we use realloc, we know that it has to copy sometimes. And second, iterate through keeping track of where the end of the string currently is and just copy each argument onto the end. But another unfortunate thing about StringCat is that's not the most natural way to write this code with StringCat. Like, keeping track of where the end of the string is not like naturally supported that way. We'd have to do it separately. Because, for example, even StringCat doesn't really tell us where the end of the string is after it finishes. Okay, so one reason we showed you this code with a rather subtle memory leak is because these occur all the time in real software. So if you've ever seen you may have seen commercial software, which uses more and more memory as it keeps running. This sort of problem is usually the cause. And it's a very subtle problem compared to other things you might do with respect to pointers that are bad because, it never crashes the program. You're never going to have a seg fault from a memory leak because you're just leaving memory around that you could have freed. Fortunately, you can inspect the programs manually to figure out where you need to add the freeze, and there are tools to help out with this. Because it's actually fairly easy to figure out in a program, do I have memory leaks? Now, it's not easy to do by inspection, but if you think of implementing malloc, that's easy to do. Malloc has this list of free chunks, and it knows how much stuff it allocated. So it can just count. It can just say, hey, did I allocate more stuff than I have free when the program exits? And so malloc can easily tell you, yes, you leaked some memory, or no, you didn't. And with a little extra work, we could keep track of where did you do that at each allocation, and we could figure out what did you allocate, that wasn't free. Where did you do a malloc that didn't end up being free? And in fact, there are several tools for doing this. And we can do better than assuming you free it at the end of the program, and we can just look when your program finishes at all the pointers you have and say, do you even have a pointer to this? And so we can take care of the case where you have a global variable where you allocated some memory, and we can check, let's just look at all the global variables and see if there's anything which might be a pointer. to the memory you allocated. We might get it wrong sometimes because we might confuse an integer with a pointer. We can just look at all that memory and say, are there any things that might be pointers that look like the address of this chunk of allocated memory? And if you don't have that, well, probably you have no way of freeing it. Even if, you didn't write the code to free all the things allocated, like for global variables, like for example, if you have a global variable that's a vector, yeah, you probably don't free that. And it's not a big deal. And there are two ways you can access this sort of functionality. So some implementation of malloc, if you pull up your system's documentation, have some sort of debugging modes. And one of the things these debugging modes will often do is they will tell you, where you actually allocated memory that wasn't freed. These debugging modes can also often do other helpful things, like try to figure out if you're writing outside the bounds of your allocations more aggressively than normally, or try to check whether you're writing to freed memory more aggressively than they would normally. Like normally they just depend on you getting unlucky and overwriting something that's used. They have debugging modes where they'll try to make those cases show up consistently. So one example is that in the debugging mode, when you free memory, they might overwrite it with some pattern so you know that you're accessing memory that you shouldn't be, rather than relying on only occasionally them actually returning it to the OS and you getting a seg fault. There are also these other tools which are more generic. They don't depend on a particular malloc implementation and are designed just for debugging memory errors. And some examples are Valgrind Memcheck and Address Sanitizer. I understand that one of the labs mentioned Memcheck, maybe Valgrind or TAs, yeah. And these detect memory leaks and some other memory errors. And because of the some other memory errors issue, they're fairly high overhead. Also because they keep stack traces and give stack traces, that's another source of overhead. Like, so every malloc, they have to record what was on the stack, what function was being called, so on. In addition, they do all this extra tracking to find other memory errors. So if we take our buggy concat program here and run it through, say, for example, Address Sanitizer, we get output like this, where it says, oh, you allocated stuff here, and it was a memory leak. And Valgrind Memcheck will give you something similar. You allocated stuff here, and it was a memory leak. A common piece of confusion when people look at this output is that they assume, oh, there's an error on line 8, because that's how I'm used to dealing with errors. And like when the compiler tells me something's wrong in line 8, I change line 8. Here, you don't change line 8. That's where you're mallocing the memory. You probably don't free the memory in the same place, because you want to use it after you malloc it. And that's often true of most of these errors. Like the error occurs in some place, but that doesn't mean you can fix it there. Like it's about, that tells you what the pointer is, but you have to look at where is that pointer used to figure out how to fix the error. And Valgrind Memcheck or Address Sanitizer can also detect other types of errors. And this is where they're doing something, that's less obvious than just let's count our allocations and compare it to what gets freed at the end. So for example, if you write past the end of an array, and we're doing it in a way which can't be detected statically, so I have a separate file, it's going to say, oh, you have a heap buffer overflow. And similarly, Valgrind Memcheck will say, you have an invalid write. And it's pretty remarkable that this is something that can be implemented kind of efficiently. So Address Sanitizer and Valgrind Memcheck have like a 2 to 10x slowdown, which is a lot. But to do this sort of thing, they have to be doing some check on every single write and read, because they also check reads to figure out whether it's in bounds. And that's something they, in fact, can do. And it's pretty remarkable that that's possible. So that's my brief talk about memory errors and just mentioning that these tools exist, because, you know, it's kind of a pity that if you like try to develop C in the real world or C++ and don't have access to tools like this. Okay. So finally, a note about sort of topic of Big O matters. So we looked at Big O a bunch. And Big O had this big assumption that operations take the same amount of time. And we saw, you know, in these classes a bunch of ways that doesn't quite hold true. So caches were one big example of that. So Big O doesn't take into account caches. We assume we're accessing an array, takes the same amount of time every time. We know because of how caches work, that's not true in the real world. Big O also doesn't take into account, like, you have different versions of instructions that have different efficiencies. It doesn't take into account constant factors of space and time, which with something like caches can really matter, because if something fits in this small storage or doesn't, that's a big change in your performance. With caches in particular, thing you should be aware exists, but we're not going to talk about, that there are ways of analyzing something like asymptotic complexity that takes into account caches. So there are types of algorithm analysis that considers that, oh, we have caches, we can't assume that if we have a giant array of a billion things or a trillion things, that accessing each item of the array takes the same amount of time. So there is ways of doing algorithm analysis that takes that into account, which produces actually, in some cases, useful results. So we're going to talk, to finish up, about one little topic of this sort of case where Big O kinds of fails us, and that's about recursion versus, you know, iteration. This is something we're going to look at called tail recursion. So recursion and iteration, do they have a Big O difference, first of all? No. So that's kind of true and kind of not. So generally speaking, they don't. But we have this issue with normal versus tail recursion. So here, if we have this type of recursion, our implementation on the stack is conceptually we're going to have x on the stack, then we're going to have x minus 1 on the stack, then x minus 2, and something like that. Because when we call factorial recursive, we need to store the old x and then multiply the result by that. So I have this other way of writing it, where I cast this extra argument. And in that case, well, conceptually, like, I still have a return address, conceptually, the way we've learned function calls work. So this is as efficient, though I've avoided needing to keep around this x times by keeping my intermediate result in a variable, in an argument, and passing that argument. But it turns out that the second form is a lot more efficient. And it doesn't seem like it would be with how we've discussed how function calls work. Because we think, you know, function calls, you have a return address, you still need to push it. Here, we have to push a little extra. So that seems like, oh, it's just a factor of 2, like difference in space. Like, it's not an asymptotic difference. But the way compilers often compile this, you know, this would be an asymptotic difference because there's a shortcut you can take in the second case. So here's a way a compiler might compile that second version, the tail recursive version. Because the last operation is just a function call, and we just return afterwards without changing anything, we can skip the function call and just jump to the function we're calling. Because we know that the return address is already in place. So rather than calling and returning, you know, we can just jump to the function. The function's going to say, oh, my return address is the old return address anyways. And it's going to return for us. So, you know, the function will return for us. So this transformation makes sense, why we can substitute this jump for a call and followed by a return. So this is something called tail recursion. So this function is tail recursive because the tail of the function is the recursive call. Here, that's not the case because the last operation the function needs to do is actually this multiply. So we have to have a real return address that goes back to our caller. We can't take this shortcut of just jumping to the old function. And tail recursion, when compilers do that transformation, which is easy to do, and in fact some languages like require compilers to do, you know, saves a lot of stack space. In fact, it saves a big O significant amount of stack space. So even though time-wise there's no asymptotic difference, space usage-wise there is. And it makes a big difference in performance if the compiler can do this. And this is easy to do even in some cases which seem a little less obvious. So for example, let's say, well, this function, nicely, everything's in registers. What if that weren't the case? What if, like, we had to save something to the stack? Well, that's fine. We can just pop it before we do the jump. The function we jump to, if it has to save that again, that's fine. It's going to save the version of our actual caller. And it's going to operate correctly. And like you've learned with the equivalence between iteration and recursion, tail recursion happens to be the case which is also easiest to transform into a loop. Yeah. So we can just automatically transform this as our tail call is a jump to the beginning, our loop is a jump to the beginning. And in fact, this is also a thing compilers will do. So in fact, you know, you might say, you might presume that, you know, I would have gotten this from a compiler, and I did. But I actually had to set the optimization settings really weirdly to make this happen. Because by default, most of the compilers, if you optimize, will turn it into a loop where they'll, you know, not jump to the beginning of the function. That because, you know, it's pretty mechanical to do this transformation. And you can, of course, do it manually. So any questions about this? OK, so this is all the material I have, and I believe matches up with the slides Florian has, maybe a few extra things. So next Monday, the schedule says like esoteric programming languages, which is like a sort of a bonus topic. Bloomfield likes talking about it, about that we never test about. I'm more inclined to say, well, you have a final coming up. Probably I should talk about material that you haven't gotten from the previous semester. So I intend to run something akin to an exam review session. The way I run exam review sessions is I take questions. If you do not have questions about something, I won't talk about it. And if you aren't here, you're listening to a recording, and you won't be able to ask questions. So that's what I intend to do on Monday, is just run an exam review. And if we run out of questions, we'll end early. Probably that won't happen. So see you next Monday.